Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming out today. Welcome. Sonia Livingston. Professor Livingston received her MFA in creative writing from the University of New Orleans, where a thesis, later the essay collection Ghost Bread, was awarded distinction. Before that, she also earned an MSED in counselor education from SUNY Brockport. Really interesting various paths for her to draw upon. She comes to us from the University of Memphis, where she was a visiting assistant professor and then a non-visiting assistant professor from 2010 to 2016. We're able to steal her, which is great. Before that, she taught in the University of New Orleans writing abroad program, which I think you still do, yes?
Yeah, some summers.
That's great. And also, she has taught in the UCLA online extension writers program. Right now, she's working on probably numerous things, but definitely The Heart is a First Class Relic, an essay collection in progress that today's talk is drawn from, yes?
Yes.
Excellent. Previously, she published Ladies' Night at the Dreamland, an essay collection from University of Georgia Press. In 2016, it was part of the Crux series in literary nonfiction, and it went into paperback this spring and was named a best nonfiction book of 2016 by Kirkus. Before that, she published Queen of the Fall, an essay collection and a memoir collection at the University of Nebraska Press book in 2015, finalist for the American Lives series, also for the Grey Wolf Nonfiction Prize. For that, Ghost Bread memoir, drawn from her essay collection that she did with her thesis, came from UGA Press, 2009 paperback, and the next year it was a winner of an AWP Prize in nonfiction. Published, I think, a dozen anthologies, widely anthologized already. Published several dozen essays. She's also a very widely published poet, and in her spare time, she's also published some short stories as well. Way too many honors and awards to actually name, but for a few. She's the winner of the Vandermeer Nonfiction Prize from Ruminate Magazine last year, and she's named the Best Book of 2016 by Kirkus. In 2016, she was included in 33 Life-Changing Books in honor of International Women's Day by Lit Hub. A real range of awards and honors. She's an NEA Citywide Reading Program 2016 winner. She's twice won funds from the Deming Fund for Women in Nonfiction. Notable essays in Best American Series Fund 2004, 2013, 2014, 2017. I could go on and on, all the way back to her first AWP Intro Award in Nonfiction in 2002. So without further ado, welcome Professor Livingston.
Thank you, Rivka, and thank you all for being here. After all of that, I can't believe that I'm going to get up here and talk about the Roman Catholic Church. If somebody ever told me you're going to talk to a group of people about the Roman Catholic Church, I would not believe it. And I think that those are the best topics for writing, those things that you don't want to get up and talk about. I don't know how they're going to work for my PowerPoint talk. We'll see how it goes. So I just want to give you a little bit of background on this project, which is really focusing in on Roman Catholic tradition. A couple years ago, I was working on a novel. I'm still working on that novel. I think I'm going to work on that novel till I die because I don't think I'm a novelist. But the novel is set in Niagara Falls and has an important scene that's centered around a celebration of St. Joseph's Day. And it's March 19th, 2 days after St. Patrick's Day. And it's a communal celebration with food and all kinds of, well, it's just food. Basically, it's food and St. Joseph statues. But it's a fun tradition. And in writing, I wanted to interview people who have, it's called to give a table, people who have given tables, which is to open your home to anybody who comes for this celebration. And so I checked with a friend when I was back up in Rochester about, like, who are some good sources for the St. Joseph's tradition? And I was referred to a woman named Mary Engels, who was 93 at that time, she's 97 now. And she, I guess, is the queen of all things St. Joseph, and definitely the queen of St. Joseph's tables. So I called her up, and I said, I would like to meet you and interview you, and where would be a good place? And she said, honey, just come to Mass. That's where I always am, Mass. So I come to Mass, which is in, by the way, my old church. I grew up mostly going to the same Roman Catholic church in Rochester, New York, called Corpus Christi. So I went back to Corpus Christi after 25 years away or something, and met with Mary, went to Mass a couple times, she insisted on it, and was really sad, I guess, to see that there weren't many people there. The people who were there were, you know, if you were 75, you were one of the young ones, you know, older crowd, and the building was sort of sooty, and the statues looked a little grimy, like it wasn't being kept up, and I knew, because everybody I grew up with, it seems like, was Catholic, and none of them are anymore, I knew theoretically or intellectually that churches were dying. I've read about it. But to sit in the church that I'd grown up in, see that it was a dying church, really didn't surprise me. But what surprised me was the fact that I cared. So that surprise and that caring is what led me to returning to that church to try to find out what was going on. Like, what is this lingering connection? Because intellectually, it didn't really make sense. And so I embarked on a series of expeditions to sort of check out with new eyes Roman Catholic traditions or or maybe traditions that I hadn't really understood, with a real focus on devotion itself. I forgot to say when I went back to that church, the altar servers were adults, because there were not even kids in the church to be altar servers, which if you grow up Catholic, you know, like usually it's a child. So it was just a really, really jarring experience. Jarring, but very typical. In the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states, churches for the past two decades have been closing. So the reason for those closures are dwindling vocations, shifting demographics, people who lived in those cities, immigrants who came to work in factories moved away or their children moved away. You know, the scandals don't help that have been going on. I was going to say the past couple decades, but the summer was big for that. I think more than that, even people who remain Catholic in identity don't really agree with church teachings on matters of sexuality or gender. So again, I understood intellectually about why those seats were so empty and why the churches were dying, but I wanted to know a little bit more. So I just wanted to very quickly give you statistics on U.S. Catholics, and these are from 2014. I don't want to be a pessimist, but I think they're probably continuing in this direction and even worsening, especially after, you know, it was a really bad summer for the Catholic Church. Between 2007 and 2014, the number of U.S. Catholics dropped by 3 million in the United States. For every new convert to Catholicism, six left. 13% of the population, when asked their religious category, identified themselves as former Catholics. And the largest increase, and maybe you know this, but the largest increase in any religious group was the religiously unaffiliated, the so-called nuns, who in 2007 were 16% of the population, but in 2014 accounted for 23% of the population. So part of my curiosity was this personal stake in the church and kind of having this history, but I was also thinking more largely, like, what happens to us when we understand the reasons for throwing off religion, but what do we lose, if anything, when those traditions are lost? All right, so I'm going to talk about some of the expeditions, but before I talk about the places that I went, because by expedition I do mean travel, I also want to talk about the sort of writing that I did. So I write literary essays, and that sounds like a pretty straightforward category of writing, but I think that they are also a form of expedition, so I just wanted to talk a little bit about them. So expeditions refer to the various journeys, like I said, that I made with points of to either sites or processions or parades. So they were the physical trips, but they also refer, in my thinking, to the writing itself, and specifically this form. A creative essay seems to me the perfect vehicle for an exploration, because the form often functions as a written quest. So it sort of mimics that searching that I was doing physically. The essays in this project often juxtapose, synthesize, accrete various conceptual threads, resulting in a dynamic, intuitive, nonlinear contemplation of material on the subject. That's a lot of words. But basically, I'm coming at these subjects from a lot of different angles within the text. These compositions are actually becoming more and more popular, and literary journals and essayists are publishing collections of these types of essays, these sort of multi-layered essays. They're sometimes called mosaic essays or segmented essays. There are probably like five other names for them. Nobody seems to agree. Nobody really agrees on what creative nonfiction is. So as a subgenre of the already confused genre, this gets a little confused too. But these are some of the names for them. They're more commonly called lyric essays. And this subgenre was identified a couple decades ago when creative nonfiction writing and writing programs began to explode in the culture. I don't know if they exploded. They made their presence known a couple decades ago. So, like I say, nobody really agrees, and some people will read an essay that has poetic language and call it a lyric essay when maybe they mean that it's a lyrical essay. So you may read a collection called lyric essays, and it may look different from the next collection of lyric essays that you read. The Seneca Review is a literary journal that began publishing these essays back in 1997, and they gave this name, the lyric essay, and they also defined the form as a subgenre that straddles the essay and the lyric poem. These poetic essays or essayistic poems forsake narrative line, discursive logic, and the art of persuasion in favor of idiosyncratic meditation. So they're not reporting, and they're not transcripts for sure, and they're not persuading. They're moving, as I say, quite like the journeys that I was making externally. They also say the form is often associative, leaping from one path of thought to another by way of image or connotation, advancing by juxtaposition or sidewinding poetic logic. Loyal to the original sense of the essay as a test or a quest, it's an attempt at making sense. The lyric essay sets off on an uncharted course through interlocking webs of idea, circumstance, and language, a pursuit with no foreknown conclusion, an arrival that might still leave the writer questioning. While it's ruminative, it leaves pieces of experience undigested and tacit, inviting the reader's participatory interpretation. So again, that's a different, when you think of an essay, you may not be thinking of these question marks that so much inhabit this particular form. Another writer of this form, Judith Kitchen, a poet, and many of the people who write lyric essays and publish them, come from poetry. They're poets who have taken up prose in this particular form. Or maybe they don't even identify it as a lyric essay. To them, it may feel like an extended poem. But so this is one such writer, and she's a poet critic. She says, the meditative essay is characterized by the question mark as a writer interrogates the meanings of his or her experience. If the meditative essay is a brand of personal essay, then the lyric essay is often a brand of meditative essay. In a lyric essay, however, the question mark has frequently gone underground. It resides at the periphery as an impulse more than as an organizing device. Thus, the lyric essay is a natural home for writers whose logic is not so dependent on building an argument or trajectory as on finding or forcing connection. I can't remember if Judith Kitchen had logic in quotes. I hope that's really from her. But I like that it's in quotes and that the earlier attempt at definition talked about poetic language. It's really a different way of knowing, of exploring, that's rich in language. I'm working on an essay right now about St. Kateri Tikakwitha, and she was canonized recently, I think 2014, as the first Native American saint. So she's from upstate New York. She was born near the Mohawk River. She had a horrible life. There was a smallpox epidemic and her family was wiped out. She also was scarred and severely disabled by the epidemic, so lost a lot of her eyesight. And so that was when she was four. She went to live with her family in another village. A couple years later, that village was burned by the French. So basically a really tough beginning and sort of forced to accept a missionary's presence or die, right? So by the time she was 24, she was a devout Catholic. She died, it said that her skin cleared up and lightened. So she turned European as her miracle. So what am I interested in is representations of Kateri. So that's category one. The interest is, and then here are some images of her. There's some really early ones here you can see that the French made or the French Canadians. And then this one, which is more recent and probably a lot more what she looked like. And then this one here is actually a picture of my sister. My youngest sister is part Iroquois, and local artist was trying to write a children's book about the saint and asked my sister if she would be the model for Kateri, which is funny because none of us are saints in the family, but she is especially not a saint. So that's the personal stake. The specific point of connection is that I went to Kateri's birthplace and some shrines up in upstate New York and also Quebec. And then the question, it's something about whether she's an inclusive symbol to be celebrated. Like, I've seen so many Native American Catholics happy because they have a saint who looks like them. But then there's also that hard-to-avoid reality that she's a whitewashed symbol, sort of compliance. And so I think where my essay is going is somewhere there. But this is just an illustration to say how I will come from a lot of different directions, but it will end up with those four categories that I don't know usually until I've written. Okay, so these are some of the expeditions. All right, so the heart as a first-class relic. This was the first expedition I took, and each essay has so many layers that I'm not even going to try to go through them all, but I'll just give you a couple of the main strands. And the main strand of this one was really about the use of relics by Roman Catholics. And again, I was often motivated by the things that I didn't understand or the things I was really embarrassed of as a kid. Those are often like good signs that there's something there, you know, like what's going on there? I didn't understand this. I don't know if I still understand it, but I wanted to know more. So I went to St. Joseph's Oratory in Montreal, and this, you can't see well, which is good, but this is his heart relic. And he was known as Brother Andre before he was canonized. I think he was canonized in 2010. He's much beloved up in French Canada for his generosity. So I went to see the oratory, and I went with a tour group and watched as people went before the reliquary, and some people prayed before it, and people just sort of looked, and I sat behind judging everybody, like, look at them looking at that heart relic, and then I'm like, well, wait a minute, I'm here too looking at them looking at the heart relic. But again, the essay focuses on the use of relics and devotion itself. So this is stairs leading up to the dome of the oratory, and I didn't take a full picture to show all the flights of stairs, but it says reserved for pilgrims going up on their knees. So it's a tradition at this place that some people climb the oratory steps on their knees as a show of devotion. And going back to Mary, the 93-year-old who I met a couple years ago, she actually told me about going to this oratory and said that when her boyfriend George asked her to get married back in like 1949, she said, I don't know, I think I better pray about it. I'm going to go to the oratory. So she goes to the oratory. This is her story. I didn't fact check it. And she climbs all of these steps on her knees, gets to the top, and she thinks she hears Joseph saying yes. So she marries him. So the essay really focuses on this heart relic, this idea of devotion, and really the way that these things do not make sense to me. I don't think that they make sense when you think about them logically. The essay ended up being pretty important, or the expedition, because it forced me to get out of my normal way of thinking and judging and trying to make sense. All of that was still there. But in order to continue these expeditions, I really had to be open to a different way of knowing. And this was definitely that. I also talk about that heart relic being stolen. Back in 1974, some thieves broke into the oratory, stole the heart relic, and tried to ransom it. And the bishop refused to pay, saying, nope, we're not going to pay to get that relic back. But all of that just worked symbolically for me, this idea of having a relic that's a heart, of having it stolen, of bowing before it. Okay, the next expedition was inspired by confession. Much like PowerPoint, I haven't gone to confession in a couple decades, you know? Like, I haven't used PowerPoint much. And when I first was going back to church, I started to think, man, maybe I should be going to confession. And then I thought, no, you're all right. You don't need to go. And what I found out is that I wasn't alone. Actually, only 2% of people who call themselves Catholics go to confession on a regular basis, which is at least once a month. 12% go once a year. Everybody else goes less than that or not at all. Again, it's a dying tradition, and I was curious about that. Like, what's up with that? I understood rationally, but I also was wondering what happens to us when we lose these traditions. So I found out about a priest who converted an ambulance into a mobile confessional unit. Of course, that happens all the time. So he's down in Louisiana, and he drives it all over Cajun country. There it is, spiritual care unit. And he parks it outside of bars, festivals, gyms, and when I visited, we went to a strip mall and parked outside of a Subway sandwich shop. And so the sisters come along, they have a community, and they set up French hymns, and very friendly, they're handing out, you know, brochures with the examination of conscience. And so they have the materials, they get people to come and confess their sins. And I did this because I thought it was so over the top, it might actually forced me to go in and confess. It did not do that, actually. It scared me a little. But it was an interesting way to experience that sacrament and to think about it a little bit more. So he's traveled thousands of miles and heard thousands of confessions. He's in a very sort of conservative religion. The 2% who are going to confession regularly may live here already. So the people at the Subway sandwich shop were all over it. You know, they went in and got their foot long, and they were right in that confessional booth. That's actually a picture of my parish back home, back up in Rochester. I wanted to go to confession to write about confession, and I did eventually. And I just wanted to say that this is how confession looks these days, not outside with a garbage can. This just happened to be a festival, but people meet with the priest and talk in an informal way a lot of the times. And so I was also interested in like this space between what she's saying and he's hearing and whether and what can happen there. Devil's advocate. There, in 1967, there was a fire at a church called St. Philip Neri in Rochester, New York, very close to where I would eventually be born, and so that's the personal connection there. In that fire, both a priest and a nun died because when the alarm was sounded, the priest was concerned about the consecrated host in the church, which he believes is the body of Christ. So he ran in, she ran in, they did not make it out. And what interested me here is the way that those people are talked about 50 years later. So at the time, Fulton Sheen was bishop up in Rochester. And so he said about the sister, and she had just turned 26 2 days before she died. The priest was 77. So there were just, you know, two different phases of life. But he says, Sister Lillian Marie gave her life helping Father Weinman save the Blessed Sacrament from fire. Greater love than this no woman hath. So, of course, it's the second part of that that set me off a little bit. Like, really? What is that? And when I began to read newspaper articles and eyewitness accounts, what I found out is that actually she did not follow him into the burning building to help retrieve the Blessed Sacrament. She was concerned about school children who were in the church because it was cold in February and they often hid in there. And so I'm just really interested in how that story has been told over the years and what they say. I also talk about the process of becoming a saint and what it means and what it means to be a sinner. Bishop Sheen was a really popular figure for a long time. He had TV shows, and he himself is a candidate for sainthood, but his sainthood is being held up because, I don't know if you guys know about this, his home diocese in Peoria, Illinois, needs his body from the diocese in New York City, and they're refusing to give Bishop Sheen's bones back to Illinois. So there's like this big fight. So the essay becomes really a meditation on what it means to be a saint, what are these stories that we tell, and how we categorize and put people into groups even after they're gone. This is Feast of the Epiphany. I'll just quickly say that it's a major feast in the Orthodox Church. I went down to Tarpon Springs, which has the highest percentage of Greek Americans in the United States, and they celebrate Epiphany in a really big way. In fact, they're known as Epiphany City. I don't know if they're known outside of Tarpon Springs as Epiphany City, but they are Epiphany City. Before they were Epiphany City, they were known as the sponge capital of the world, because their sponging was a huge industry for them. And in fact, that's how the Greeks came. They recruited skilled Greek divers to come to Tarpon Springs. And the Greeks came and built their culture and brought their traditions with them. And so every January 6th, a group of boys, this year it was 57 when I went to see, have a procession down to the local bayou where the bishop throws the cloth in and then they all dive. And so the essay really looks at Epiphany as a feast, an overlooked feast in the Roman tradition, the idea of diving in faith. That is the kid who found it. It's sort of impressive. They just sort of run down there and jump right in. The Moving Statues of Ireland. Does anybody remember this? Again, you probably had lives in the 80s, but this was back in 1985. Well, some of you did not have lives in the 80s. And I use a trip to Ballinspittle in County Cork. I go to the grotto. I'm visiting a friend, and she says, oh, have you seen this grotto before? So I say, no, let's go. And we both are sort of formerly Catholic, but still interested in grottos, so there's that. But back in 1985, all across Ireland in the summer of 1985, people claimed to see statues moving. And so one person claimed it, and then another person claimed it, and it was like the summer of moving statues. Like, they could not stay on their pedestals in 1985 in Ireland. So I have a quote here. In July, Cathy O'Mahony stopped by the grotto at Ballinspittle to say the rosary with her two daughters when they noticed movement up the hill. Both said the Virgin's chest rose and fell as it filled with air. The next night, 100 people flocked to Ballinspittle. Some saw the Virgin change expression. Others reported seeing her wave or smile or even blush. I looked up and saw Our Lady ascending into heaven, said Josephine Foran. Her face became human like a baby's with its lovely pink flesh. And so I have just list a long quotes from people who attest to these virgins or these statues moving. And there's a shot of some people in the rain looking at the statue. A lot of them reported seeing movement, and a lot of them report just waiting to see movement. The other strand of this essay involves this girl, Anne Lovett, who in 1984, the year before, died while giving birth. It says a field here, but she actually went to her, most of the villages and towns have their own grotto of the Virgin Mary. She went to the Virgin Mary, it's a grotto, and gave birth. Nobody seemed to know she was pregnant. Birth control was illegal, abortion was unheard of, and so she went there and gave birth in a really cold day, and sadly, both she and the baby died. So those two strands sort of work together. What is it about seeing these statues move? And what is it about the background, maybe, of these people in the culture? What was going on that might have led to their need to see statues move, or the ability to see statues move? I'm sure some men report seeing statues move. In fact, I know. But primarily women were going to these grottos. And primarily women were really invested in this story of seeing movement. So the essay talks about that, the ability to move in a culture where your body doesn't have the ability, you don't have the freedom to do what you need to with your body.
this is just a photograph of the holy well at County Clare, and interested just basically looking at holy water with this site. And there's inside the grotto and outside, which has a tree over the top of the well with lots of ribbons, or people will take a piece of their shirt or pants or something and tie it there. And again, inside the grotto. The Marigold Parade, this was a trip to New Mexico, and basically it involved two things. It involved going to the Day of the Dead Parade in Albuquerque's South Valley, and there that is. That was really interesting because I saw lots of beautiful skeletons. So there are, as you know, the Day of the Dead is all about painting your face with a skull, but little kids were chomping into candy skulls, and so it was an odd sight to see these beautifully painted skulls and then biting skulls. I happened to be traveling with a friend whose sister recently died. That's the part of these essays that I couldn't plan, right? I knew that we were going to go on this trip. Her sister was diagnosed with cancer, and it ripped through her, and she died very quickly. And so I think because of that, all of these sort of death images really stood out. I was aware of them. I was hyper aware, thinking, wow, is Janine upset about this? But that's what I was actually interested in, is the pairing. Their parade is called Muertos and Marigolds Parade, so Death and Flowers Parade, like the pairing of those two things, which would seem not to go together. I also went to Chimayo, a sanctuary up in the north of New Mexico, and among other things, they have what's called the Holy Dirt Room, and people, they get some dirt, they put it on themselves, or they put it in an envelope or some sort of container and take it home, and it's said to have healing properties. And in the old days, it was said that the whole magic refilled every night after the pilgrims left, because tons of people are going through here. It's one of the top pilgrimage sites in the U.S. But now workers admit that they go to the nearby mountains and refill the hole every night, but they don't think that that detracts from it. And actually, I don't think it detracts from it either. And the essay really meditates this idea of sacredness and dirt, death and life, and how those things that are seemingly paradoxical can work together. A Brief History of Prayer. I signed up for a retreat at the Monastery of the Holy Spirit in Atlanta, Georgia. It's a Trappist monastery, and I thought it was called Prayer in the Image of God. And I'm like, I'm not good at prayer. I want to learn more about prayer and the image of God. Like, I'm all over that. So also, I should admit that the monks make really good biscotti and fudge. They advertise on their website, so I'm like, I will also eat that food. So as I was heading down there, I was driving south, and then somewhere in North Carolina, I just couldn't go anymore. I think maybe I'd overdone the Catholic stuff. I don't know. Even thinking about the biscotti did not keep me on the road. So I rode off the road and headed toward the Outer Banks. I went to the visitor center because I needed a place to stay. I hadn't planned it. And I hadn't been to the Outer Banks, but I know about Kitty Hawk and all that. The guy was so nice. He was probably 90, and he pulled out a brochure, and I saw that it was going to be about the Wright brothers. And I already was in pain, because for some reason I've never really liked the Wright brothers. There's no reason for it, but I thought, I don't care about the history of flight, don't show me this. But he showed it to me, and it was a photograph from, I think, 1903, when they got their machine in the air. So he showed me that, and then he pulled out another photo from his pocket, and this was from the day or two before they actually successfully flew, and he pointed to this boy and said, "That's my daddy." And something about "That's my daddy" really got me. So I'm just looking at this photo. Anyway, the essay becomes a meditation on prayer and the history of flight. So I ended up caring about the history of flight, mostly because of the way he let me see the Wright brothers struggled before they flew, right? Just like, I don't really get a lot of what prayer is about, but I would like to. They tried for years to get that heavy piece of bulky machinery into the air, and guess what? It did eventually fly. Anyway, instead of going to the official retreat, I went to the beach for a couple days. I've got two more. I will just very quickly say that this is a statue of the Virgin Mary from the church that I grew up in. It was fading by the time that I started in that church, right? So by the time I came onto the scene, it was already an urban Catholic church that wasn't doing very well. But as I said, things really changed later. In its heyday, in Rochester, in the northeast section, which is where I'm from, there were 17 Roman Catholic churches. There are two today, or parishes, and this is one of them. But what's happened is that over time, they don't just close, they merge. So a church closes, and as Mount Carmel closes, the people all then go to the next church that's closest to them. And they don't just come to the church that's closest to them, they bring their stuff with them. So they bring their statues, they bring relics, they bring things with them. And so when I first went back to the church, I actually convinced my Protestant husband to come with me to Mass, and it was loaded with statues. And I was sort of embarrassed or defensive and said, you know, there aren't usually this many. But what it was is that it was a collection from all of those churches. So if they each had four or five, they were then suddenly there. And all those switching around of statues, the one that I grew up with was gone. And so at some point, I began to search for her. Now, that is an indication that I do need a life. Like, I am clear on that. But at some point, she became for me a symbol of that particular church, of Catholicism itself, and the changing face of Catholicism. That's a room that I was allowed to do research in, because at first I thought, I want to write a history of this church before I decided to look for the statue. And what this just shows is that each one of these filing cabinets is a church. It's like 100 years of baptisms, marriages, confirmations, funerals, all of that. And so that, again, it hit me. This is a factory in Pittsburgh. It's the first place that I went to. I wanted to know what happens to devotional objects such as statues when churches close. And so this was one place that gets them, repairs them, and sells them. It was loaded with statues. If you have fear of statues, don't look at this. I ended up finding a statue in Buffalo, New York. There was a woman who has started a museum that's loaded with these objects, devotional objects. I ended up finding the statue there, but it was meaningful to me that the statue was in a museum and not in an active parish. And then finally, altar girl, or the female body at Mass. I'm really interested in here the ban on women in sacred spaces. And so I focus on an altar server. This is at the church back up in Rochester. And this isn't a great photo, but she's just full of life. So I wrote a profile of her and really just started to think about the female body. And it's hard to talk about ordination for women. People get nuts about it or not, you know, depending on your view. People are reset. But talking about children serving on the altar, people are a little more open. So I was focused on her to do that. Most American parishes do use female altar servers, but some places have banned them. Back in 1993, the Vatican said they're allowed. You can invite them, but it's up to you if you want to ban them. So most places don't ban them, but there are a few places that ban them, and some clerics have been outspoken in their opposition. Cardinal Burke, for instance, made news in 2015 when he blamed the drop in priestly vocations and the drop in Catholicism on what he called the feminization of the church. And that's just a photo I took while in Ireland. I happened to be at the cathedral and saw a sign that Cardinal Burke was going to be there, so I went to the Mass. And the essay is really about trying to make sense of this sort of the female body. Here's a photo of altar servers back in 1980. One of them's actually my sister. But in our parish, which was very progressive, girls were allowed on the altar. As that particular church grew, not only did girls serve on the altar, but more and more women increasingly were up on the altar. If you grew up Catholic, you probably never see this, right? A woman elevating the host or helping out with the Eucharist. Well, like I say, in that parish, it happened, and eventually the priest was fired. I mean, they gave it a nice word. Well, eventually it became excommunication, but eventually the church went into schism. And so what is that to say? That is to say that as I look at women's bodies being allowed into the sacred space, I'm also looking at what has happened when people have broken those rules. You know, what are the costs? But I'm also, and I think this is the last slide, I'm also interested in what is lost, because I started with that little girl, and she, you know, if she was in this room, she'd light it up because she's so amazing. It was not lost to me that this church is dying, in need of life, and yet won't accept that which is right before it. So that was really fast and sloppy. Might not have felt fast to you, but talking about some of the essays or expeditions that I've done, I appreciate your attention and would be happy to entertain questions or not entertain questions.
Give her a hand while we give her a question. Any questions?
Yes.
Sure.
This was really fascinating and interesting. Thank you. I'm just curious why you chose to call your journeys expeditions rather than pilgrimages, or if you think about that term at all, or
yeah,
change the meaning for you.
You know, that's interesting, because when I think about the manuscript, another title I've considered, right now it's The Heart is a First Class Relic, because there are different types of relics, and first class is the type that a heart fits into. But the other title I've thought of is The Dusty Pilgrimess, because there's a theologian back in 1963 referred to the church as the Dusty Pilgrimess, as tired and searching.
And that sort of fits me too. Like, I feel pretty tired in searching, but I didn't, because I think expeditions seem a little more open to me. A pilgrim seems to know what they're about a little bit more, I think. Sometimes it felt kind of like a pilgrimage, but what I haven't talked about is some of the essays where I sort of take an expedition into language and my discomfort with even religious language. So I think it's probably that expedition seems a little more open, or open to what might happen, than a pilgrimage. Thank you.
So as I'm listening, I hear two different strands in this. One is that devotion seems to be intact. There seems to be people who are still practicing. But then there's this other side that it's dying because of the gender and poverty type equation that you're researching. So is devotion dying, or is this evidence that it's thriving?
I think it is thriving, but it's overall dying. You know, like there are these pockets and these traditions and community that seem to be keeping things alive, and they're, interestingly enough, they're more like folk traditions that are not reliant upon the institutional church for their being carried out. But I think I don't know if thriving is a word. There's still, for instance, confession. In Louisiana, more people go to confession. But in general, that sacrament really does seem to be dying out.
This is a little like Mary Caton's question, but instead of about religious language, it's about religious forms. When I think of Catholicism, I think of so many different forms, like catechism or sort of choir and song. And I'm wondering how religious forms relate to your work with the form of the lyric essay, or if they are coming up to you in these expeditions.
Yeah, I really like your question. And with the prayer, I look at specific sort of forms of prayer, but there's nothing that I'm aware of that I can speak to about that. You know, I didn't see the influence, but I think that's part of it for sure, maybe.
I follow up on that. The segmented form, there's something rosary-ish about it.
Oh, yeah.
Moving from thing to thing, but also reminds me sort of the steps of the pilgrim and going up the stairs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I thought it was really wonderful how you left spaces for us in your talk, as well as how you do it in the book, especially when you're talking about like silences and what gets lost mm-hmm. when we move away from devotion. I wonder, and this, I think, it kind of picks up on Mimi's question too, but about the meta aspect, this idea that expeditions refers to the journey, of course, but also to the form of the writing. Is there something especially meta, just intrinsically, about this kind of an essay? And or is that something that you find yourself building on consciously when you're trying to sort of have, you know, the reader, when you're entering into sort of silent spaces, or is it so intrinsic that you don't need to?
Yeah, I mean, it does feel pretty natural to me to write in this way, and I like the idea that maybe it mimics a rosary or some sort of circle of prayers, a novena. Like, great, I even want to go back and play with it and force that, you know. But the truth is that if you look at other essays that I've written before this collection, that's just sort of how I come to the material. I believe that it comes from not wanting to be an authority and to say, you know, like, this is where I'm going, and I like the idea of inviting the reader in to help make meaning. I mean, that happens anyway, but with those spaces, it's almost required, which I know is off-putting. Some readers are not going to like that. They just want a straight narrative. But as a writer, I'm a lot more comfortable in that terrain because I'm not sure what this is really about. I still am not sure, why did I go up to that heart relic, or why did I look for that statue? I could talk about it for another hour, and I still wouldn't, right? And so I think there's something about having that question mark shared that makes me, I'm not necessarily proud of this answer, but I'm comfortable with that. I'm much more comfortable with that.
Does that go into this wonderful example, the excerpt, like where you chose to break and insert empty space? I was wondering about, I don't know what goes into that.
Yeah.
I can see how in some of these broken in different places.
Yeah. I don't know what this sounds like, but honestly, I don't feel like I'm deciding where to make a break. I mean, I am deciding. But when I'm writing, for instance, if you have the excerpt, I'll start with travel. It looks like it says ravel. Unravel. It should say unravel. Personal. So what am I doing? We arrive at the Holy Well. It seems as if when that is set, now I breathe and go on to the next thing. I don't have a sense of thinking about that. What comes to me next is the body is more water than anything else. Then I follow that. And when it seems like that bead of the rosary is done, well, then I will go on to the next one. But I don't really think about it. In editing, I certainly revise and try to make them stronger.
So I was wondering, do you see yourself, I mean, this is great nonfiction, do you see yourself talking to the tradition of spiritual autobiography with this? I mean, because you're not positioning yourself as it's more of a question. And I think of something like Elizabeth Ashbridge, something much more unconventional. And then there was an intervention and I, you know, accepted Christ or something.
Yeah. Are you positioning yourself as...
Are you do you see yourself in that tradition? Are you thinking about that tradition when you're writing this?
The answer must be yes, because I found myself going back and reading books like that about people. But I don't know, because by the end, what I feel like is the end, I don't still feel comfortable calling myself a Catholic. Or maybe I'm not as certain as some people seem to be in those sort of autobiographies. But I am talking about matters of the spirit, and I am putting out there, like especially with the prayer essay, that I want to know more about it. Yeah, I wasn't comfortable as a kid, and I didn't mind saying prayers at Mass, but I didn't pray myself. I have an essay about the word God. Like, what does that mean? We're all saying this word, but what does that mean? Because I'm interrogating those areas, it relates, but I don't know that I come to any moment of revelation or sort of transformation.
I have one more question. So I noticed your photos also told a story of like racial demographics. So like the pictures you showed prominently showed like black women and then a black girl, and especially like your point about the little girl and her vivacity. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if, and like my image of sort of American Catholicism is often like white, sort of European, like the Greek community in Florida. So I'm wondering, are you also telling a story about like racial demographics in the Catholic Church? Does this relate to the feminization of the church that you're talking about, since those were also all women? What are those relationships there? Expeditions?
I think a couple things. One, maybe an urban Catholic church looks a little different than a suburban Catholic church because of who's living there. And then secondly, the one place where the Catholic Church is seeing growth is with the Latin communities. So this city has the second highest Puerto Rican population outside of New York City. And so there are a lot of Puerto Rican Catholic communities. And in fact, what I didn't say is I went to a Mass to see Mary, and that was a dying church. And then after that English Mass, the Spanish Mass happens, and suddenly there are children and more life. And so that is an area that is at least more alive than the English or traditional community.
As you did this presentation, I found at first I was engaged intellectually, and then my chest started tightening as the memories of Catholic childhood
started
to come back over me. And I wondered if there were any experiences like that for you, where you, I'm here looking at this as an investigator, I'm open-minded, I'm letting myself open this, and every once in a while, what the hell, where am I now? You know, because that's what I felt watching.
Every day, every night when I'm processing. Because I do have so many problems with the church. I think, what am I doing? Because writers, I think, are powerful. We don't know that anybody's going to read the work, but where you shine your light is important, right? So I'm like, why am I focusing on this? What am I doing? Even walking into campus yesterday with that big anti-abortion display, you know, that's not a Catholic thing, but it is a Catholic thing, and it made me really uncomfortable. And so, yes, but instead of stopping, I thought, well, maybe this is telling me that this is important. At least I chose to interpret it that way. I don't know. Maybe I was just lying to myself. I do that all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sonia, you talked about how these investigations are influencing the form of your essays, but I wondered how being exposed, say, very early on as a child to the language of the Mass and the highly ritualized language of the Mass may have influenced your prose style, the way you choose language. I grew up Episcopalian, and, you know, the language of the Book of Common Prayer was the first time I saw that language could be different from the way we speak. And I don't think I would have become a writer if I didn't have that experience.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for that question. It's great because my experience of growing up Catholic, I know that's the traditional experience, right? And some of the stuff that I think of as Catholic gives me that. But the church that I grew up in was very progressive and in a very poor neighborhood. I mean, I came from a family with 7 kids and a single mom, and church was the richest place I knew. And when I say rich, I mean language, I mean tradition, I mean visually. And so, yes, there's all of that stuff that I have problems with, but I do think that the language was a resource for me, absolutely. I mean, we didn't have a lot of books at home, and hearing prayers, hearing hymns, hearing even homilies were really important as a human being, but as a writer and sort of collecting rhythms and that sort of thing. So thank you for asking that.
Why don't we give Professor Livingston a hand then? She's very generous.
Thank you.